Welcome to the Wine Atelier Podcast, your insider's guide to mastering wine with certified sommelier Stephanie Miskew.
I have Christian Palmas, CEO of Palmas Vineyards in Napa Valley on the show today. Welcome, Christian.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time, and I am very excited about our theme today, which is red wines. This time of year, I get, you know, when it's so cold out and people are cooking like those hearty, you know, dishes, I get so many questions about and requests for just amazing red wine recommendations. And I've been a fan of your wines for a while, so I'm thrilled you could join me today.
Thank you.
Yeah, so all right, and before we dive into the wines themselves, I'd really love for everyone to hear a little bit about your family's unique journey in wine, because it's Palmas is very much a family affair, but y'all weren't born into a winemaking family. So tell me a little bit about how your family kind of found their way into the wine world.
Yeah, so, you know, originally we're from Argentina. Really moved here to the U.S. because of my father. So my father was an interventional radiologist studying in Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. And in 1979, him and my mother moved to the Bay Area so that my father could do his residency at UC Davis. And 3 days a week, he would head to UC Davis and you know, study. And then 2 days a week, he worked at the VA hospital. Mm-hmm. And on the weekends, mom and dad spent every waking minute in Napa Valley.
And why wouldn't they?
And, you know, they really fell in love with wine and everything surrounding Napa Valley in the early 80s. And, you know, Napa was a really special place in the early 80s. It was, you know, arguably it was a lot more families, far less commercialized. And but, you know, it was just a distant dream and something fun to do more than anything. So from a consumer's perspective. And my father's, you know, basically career, his research led him towards the invention of the balloon expandable stent. And the process of making the stent happen obviously took a long, long time. And actually, we moved to San Antonio, Texas, where all the FDA approval process occurred and the centralized all the research. And then finally, in the early 90s, the FDA granted approval to the first balloon expandable stent, and Johnson & Johnson licensed the technology, and the stent became quite successful. And by about 1996, my parents were in a very different, you know, the family was in a very different position in our lives. And for the first time ever, they were able to sort of maybe act on a dream, which of course the first thing they wanted to do in life was consider going back and making wine. Mm-hmm. And we were very fortunate to find this very special property, a historic property in Napa Valley, which was historically started by a man named Henry Hagen in 1876, and he founded Cedar Knoll Vineyards. Mm-hmm. Which amazingly the property maintained its contiguous acreage all the way through. Henry Hagen never survived Prohibition, but the property stayed intact. And so the same 640 acres that were back then were fortunately able to stay in place. And we were able to resurrect, restore the beautiful buildings on the property, build the winery, restore the vineyards, and start a new chapter.
I mean, that is just something. And I mean, how did you guys find this like very special place? How did you come across it? How did you know it was just the right place for you?
It wasn't easy. It had been on and off the market for quite a long time. You have to realize, you know, the structure was, I mean, the bones were there, but it had been 77 years since this property had ever had a vineyard on it.
Wow.
And so it was the furthest thing from a turnkey operation you could imagine. But what was great was the vineyards grow at three major elevations. So the property goes up and over Mount George. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of on the eastern side of the valley and encompasses sort of the three peaks of Mount George and the valleys in between them. and there's 640 acres, there's 64 acres of vines planted. And there's sort of three major elevations, one at 300 foot elevation, one at 1200 foot, and one at 1400 feet. So there's kind of three major sites where vines grow, three very different microclimates.
Yeah.
And what was so unique about the property was how much diversity in soil types, microclimates. There was a tremendous, you know, and of course, you know, we had in through history, we had learned that, you know, Henry Hagen made great use of the property in the same way, operating it as an estate grown project. But what made it quite unique was the amount of diversity that could be attained from a relatively small area, you know, just a couple square miles. And you had, you know, very, very diverse areas to grow, you know, begging to grow all five Bordeaux and some whites and, you know, and just make a really fun estate project.
Absolutely. And is it one of the largest contiguous estates in Napa now? How does it kind of fit into that? You know, that's a lot of contiguous acres together. Is it unique? It sounds very unique in that sense.
Yeah, it is unique. I think it's more unique in the sense of how long those contiguous acres have stayed together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you probably well know, Prohibition, which was devastating to so many labels back then, what happened to most of those properties was that, you know, the prohibition would occur. The banks would repossess the properties from their proprietors, and then the banks couldn't sell them, right? Because obviously, you know, they were, you know, wineries are big investments. They were big investments back then, just like they are today. And so what happened to a lot of these big estates is they were subdivided. And, you know, typically the flat areas were sold off because they were valuable for growing other agricultural things like walnuts and avocados and everything else. But the mountainsides, which were great for vineyards, the land had, you know, suddenly a very different value because of Prohibition. And a lot of those big estates were dismantled, unfortunately. Our property went through a slightly different pathway in that it was purchased in its entirety by a young guy named Norris Davis. And the Davis family, although they never grew wine grapes on the property during their tenure with the property, they fortunately kept the property together. And we bought it essentially from a descendant. So we really are sort of the third owner since Henry Hagen. So the property's only had three owners in about a little over 100 years.
That's amazing. So then you acquire the property, you find just the right place, this, you know, property that's been abandoned for a lot of years. So you not only renovated it, your family has created just this amazing marriage of tradition and technology. So when you set about renovating, rebuilding, and then building new structures as well, where did you start and how would you describe it, the winery today?
So, you know, it goes back to the vineyards themselves, you know. So we had this unique opportunity to kind of totally start fresh, right? We, you know, 77 years, no vines. So we were able to really start with a modern viticultural interpretation of this land. And that started with core samples. And I kid you not, about 4,900 core samples were taken across about 60 acres. This kind of roughly translates to, imagine if you had a grid that's sort of 40 by 40 feet, and you had kind of a, you know, an 8-foot core sample taken in that grid, you would have a pretty good understanding of how the subsurface soil structure translates through these different elevations. And so they decided to, what we did is we planted the vineyards that sort of, you know, you have to sort of delineate the vineyard. And in most cases, most vineyards are delineated based on efficiency, right? So that's why most vineyards look like rectangles, right? And mm-hmm. and all the rows kind of line up with the next vineyard next to it, so that when you get in the tractor, you can kind of tool through the vineyard and then cross the road and go right into the next one. It's for efficiency.
Right.
But we were able to do a totally different interpretation and sort of delineate the vineyard right where the soil type actually changed. And wow. So if you look at a map of our vineyards, they have this very bizarre, almost like puzzle-like shapes to them.
Yes, really, I saw that. You have great, and for those of you listening, if you ever want to check out how the vineyards are kind of broken up, they have beautiful comprehensive maps on the website. I love that about your website too, but go on.
Yeah, so these little parcels started to form, and we, of course, these are three major elevations. Like I said, we have all five Bordeaux's, we have three whites, Riesling, Chardonnay, and Muscat, and we have a little bit of Grenache for fun too. Nice. So so when we sat down to say, okay, well, this is the best interpretation of our land for the viticultural side, for diversity and, depth and giving us all the wonderful characteristics from each elevation, what would be the right winery to marry up with this opportunity? And that's really the way it was considered. Hmm. And so the winery was built with sort of three basic principles in mind. And the first principle and these principles led the design of the winery. Hmm. The first principle was, how can I take, I always like to kind of break it into, if you're sort of sitting down with your winemaking team and you're interviewing them, and yeah. The very first question I would ask them is, what is the very best thing I can do to help you guys make the best wine you can? Mm-hmm. And, of course, after they ask for access to the best fruit in the world, what winemakers love, or what they don't love, let's put it this way, is they don't like it when guys like me, who run operations and facilitate their creative abilities, what they don't like is when guys like me ask them to prematurely consolidate available ingredients. So what ideally the winemaker in the perfect world, what they would love to have is as many available ingredients at the time of blending. Mm-hmm. So if you kind of think about it like if guys like me, we make paint, right? I make a great blue and a great red and a great yellow. And then the winemakers put those colors on a palette and then they paint this incredible painting, right?
Right, right.
So what the winemaker's sort of asking or prefers to have is as many available colors on the palette.
Right, components.
It allows them to build or paint the most complex painting. It gives them a lot of options. But if I'm forcing them to pre-blend things and, if the winery's, structure constrains that process, then sometimes that can affect their ability to reinterpret things at the last minute or, obviously the best time to judge a wine is when it's done. Mm-hmm. And so because we had this property with such tremendous diversity and all these different, components, the first design feature of the winery was to build a facility that could take all of these ingredients and maintain them separate through the entire 2-year process. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we call this kind of a zero consolidation winemaking concept, in that the most fundamental ingredient in wine is simply defined as the smallest container the wine is currently stored in. So sure, on day one, it's a big fermenter, right? We have 24 fermenters, we have 24 parcels. On day, let's say 29, those 24 fermenters turn into 48 components of free run and press. And then on day 35, that component turns into 7 barrels of all beautiful French oak. And we never force them to combine, even during racking or until the blending session happens, starting 14 months in, they are allowed to keep every component separate. And it really gives them a tremendous diversity in terms of their blending creativity.
Wonderful.
So that really dictated the design feature of the winery. And it also made the winery explode in size. So although we make, kind of a measly 9,000 to 10,000 cases of wine, the winery's footprint grew drastically, north of 110,000 square feet. And the second feature didn't really help that either, in that we also it wanted to do all of this using gravity flow, right? Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the next big part of it.
Right. And just before we move on to the gravity flow for people listening, so you're saying then for like all your different vineyard parcels, they kind of have their own fermentation vessel that's tailored to the size of the exact vineyard is what you're saying.
That's correct. Yeah. So
wonderful.
Each vineyard is a particular size. And this is the beauty of an estate program, because when you're only fermenting the same grapes from the same parcel every year over year, mm-hmm. you can actually customize a vessel perfectly sized for that parcel. Wow. And so every vineyard has its own little fermenter.
That's great. Do you purchase any grapes, or you use only estate grapes for the most part?
We only use estate grapes. We do purchase a small amount. We really covet this. We purchase a small amount of Chardonnay from our friends at Hyde Vineyards, which really helps round out. We have Chardonnay at two different elevations, at the kind of the warmest area of the property and the coldest area of the property. And we felt like we needed something else that did not come from, you know, any location our property had for this right. particular Chardonnay we wanted to make. And being big fans of HDB.
So are we. Love them.
So we've had a long time, great relationship with Hyde, and that's the only fruit we purchase.
Well, that's some darn good fruit. But how wonderful to be able to work with so much estate fruit. I mean, that's great. So you were about to move on, I think, to gravity flow, which would love to hear more about that and how that makes for better wine in the end.
Yeah. So gravity flow, you know, really came, that was a new topic in the mid 90s. This idea of being gentle with wines during production really kind of was sort of a new hot button topic that all the oenologists were clamoring about. And really that came from a body of research that was sort of starting to really become understood since about the early 80s, mid 80s, and becoming widely accepted by the early 90s. And basically what changed is, in a very, very basic way, is our understanding of why wine changes in texture as it ages. Mm. So, you know, we used to think that the reason why wines would sort of change in texture as they age is because tannins would fall out of the wine, would literally precipitate out of the wine, and the wines would get silkier, softer, smoother. Mm-hmm. But what the research was leading towards an understanding that was a little bit different than that, that actually tannins are polymerizing molecules. So they actually piggyback and on each other and form these long chains. And the longer these chains get, there's an increased affinity to the protein. And so what's happening is that, you know, think about the bottle of wine. It only has so many tannins in it. Mm-hmm. And how those tannins assemble themselves, connect to each other, drastically changes the way you perceive the tannins in the wine. And so the idea is pretty simple. Since wine naturally wants to polymerize its tannins, the idea is to sort of get out of the way of the process, avoid agitation as much as possible through while we have the wines in our hands, right? Right. While right. it's in fermentation and barrel storage and rackings and, you know, filtration and bottling, if we can somehow do that process by avoiding as much agitation as possible, then theoretically the wine will be that much more, you know, further along this process, which theoretically removes some of the burden from the end consumer to lay that wine down and to achieve the same tannin polymerization level. Now, of course, aging and everything else still has its benefits, and there's no getting around that. But the idea was to bring to the bottle a wine that was sort of more tannically mature, let's put it that way. And so in the mid-90s, it became kind of vogue to avoid agitation at all costs. Now, wineries went about this in very different ways. Some of them got rid of corrugated hoses, pump designs changed, and some wineries said, well, we're going to avoid pumps altogether, and they built sort of a two-story structure with typically an elevator in, and you know, with a tank in the elevator, and they'd raise put wine in the tank, raise it up, and use gravity to flow it from point A to point B instead of using a pump. And the theory was that was more gentle, so you're preserving those delicate tannins, and the whole process would be better for it. Well, that was pretty, widely accepted. But there was one part of the process that kind of had a big compromise, and it was at the end, prior to bottling, there's one step left. We have to filter. And in order to force, red wine through a half micron filter to remove all the dead yeast cells and everything else you do because of filtration, you have to achieve a pretty high level of pressure. And of course, that two-story elevator is not tall enough to generate that pressure statically. Mm-hmm. So pumps come back into the mix, and then how much damage was caused in that one-time event was frankly unknown. And all of this led to this idea that if we were going to practice gravity flow, that we wanted to do it in a non-compromising way. So therefore, the engineers decided that the ultimate gravity flow facility needed to be about 240 feet tall, because that allowed you to make wine first and then have 133 feet left over, which at 2.31 feet per PSI, the weight of wine, gave you the right pressure to filter into and go right into the bottle without compromise. And of course, so we like to call that gravity finished wines, which, is true to its name. Our wines don't see any agitation, no pumps, from the time they're wine to the time they're in bottle.
Wow. And I have to ask, because, okay, here you guys are in the 90s building this beautiful facility, that's kind of really bringing to life these theories that are, sound theories of making better wine. How was that? Like when, just people like your neighbors there in the valley and, were people like curious? Was it well received? Was there pushback? Like how was that? Coming into the Napa Valley in that time and, building such a technologically cutting edge, beautiful winery. What was that like?
It was interesting. I think most people, all they heard was the Palmazes are going to build the largest winery in the world, right? That's all that stuck. Oh, okay. And or the tallest winery in the world, it took some time to sort of realize the impact of this project. And I'll tell you that the one thing everybody was worried about and still very, very worried about was water. And fortunately, and in fact, it by itself was so important to this project that it was the third design feature. Hmm. So the third design feature was, how do we build a facility that takes no water at all?
Wow.
And so working, and the reason water is particularly scarce in our area is because Palma's Vineyards happens to be inside of, and our mountain, Mount George, is a very important contributor to the watershed of the Millick and Sarco Tulake aquifer. It's a watershed that Coombsville, our area, is most of it sits over. And there was concern that, here we are building this incredibly advanced facility that is going to have very, very high levels of sanitation that requires lots and lots of water. And we were going to become major, users of the groundwater. And we, looking at the project, we wanted to do something, we were looking at, platinum LEED certification and all these, unique certifications, a brand new facility. That's what you do with brand new facilities. Mm-hmm. And we stumbled upon this idea that really kind of became like a challenge. And we really liked this idea that because the winery was fully underground, there would be no evaporatory loss. And so we had a chance at going for a full net zero water consumption permit, which no winery in California had ever attained before.
Wow.
And so we worked with the State Water Board. We actually hired this consultant out of Abu Dhabi and worked with GE and some other companies. And they put this team together, and they built this remarkable water treatment center that was built deep into the winery, down in level one, kind of at the bottom end of the flow, at the lowest level. And that facility takes all the processed water from the winery, treats it using an organic digestion system, and has these like giant pools with these big floating blue bioreactors inside that kind of grow this special bacteria that loves the byproducts of grapes. Hmm. And the result was it made a water that was had a BOD of under 5, which was remarkable. It was, you know, basically potable water.
Wow.
And the idea was we would store it in a tunnel that's 3 city blocks long. So 100% of the water that we use during, say, harvest, which is the most intense water using period, is useless when you're just irrigating ornamentals when it's raining outside. So to have the most benefit, we would capture all that water, keep it aerated and fresh and sealed off, and begin to use it the following year, starting in July. And that 1.7 million gallons, you know, or almost 1.9 million gallons in our peak years, those, that much water goes 100% towards our irrigation and our farming. So that's 1.7 million gallons less that you need to demand from the water table. And at the best time, right, when everyone's pumping the water table the hardest during the peak of the end of summer, we get to release ourselves 100% from that and not touch it at all. And so it really became this tremendously sort of symbiotic relationship with sort of the natural resources and the winery. And that really, we made a lot of friends in the valley.
Yeah.
With that philosophy, and you know, and everyone thought at the time, oh, this is going to be the new gold standard to what wineries would be able to do, because it was kind of a proof of concept that the byproducts that a winery could produce could actually be 100% retreated.
That's fascinating. And has it kind of set a new standard or something for people to shoot for since then?
I think so. You know, In smaller scales, yes.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen a lot of innovation in terms of, you know, wastewater treatment come from this idea. And I'd say that, you know, most wineries in the valley today are actually pretty good, you know, neighbors to water consumption. And it's created a lot of great stewards in the valley.
Wow, that's fascinating. So fascinating. And I encourage everyone listening to really go on the website, and I will link to it through mine too, and just check out the unique, there's a great, it's a video almost of the different parts of the winery, how they fit together. And it's really fascinating. And before we move on to the wines themselves, I know another key part of making your wines and keeping track of what's going on in the vineyard is the geographical information systems that you kind of implemented. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that as well?
Sure. So there were basically, you know, two systems that were designed, and this is really my background, right? So I spent my life studying wines in different formats, but never really being able to play ball stylistically at the level of our incredible winemaking team, which is comprised of Mia Klein and Tina Mitchell.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, so I basically dedicated my life to playing a supporting role to people like them who do have that talent. And so I build tools, and that's, you know, what we've always done. Our family's always, you know, built great, hopefully great tools to try and make the best wines we can.
Mm-hmm.
And so we two kind of big tools. One was called Vigor, and Vigor stands for Vineyard Infrared Growth Optical Recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And what Vigor is, it's an airplane, right? So an airplane, little Cessna, goes up in the sky twice a week, and on the belly of that Cessna there is a big array of cameras, and those cameras are multispectral cameras that take pictures in the infrared light spectrum, mm-hmm. and they take pictures of the vines. What they see is a very, very finite level of vigor variation, or, you know, variation in the metabolic rate of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And they take pictures twice a week, every Monday and every Thursday, through the whole growing season.
Right.
Of course, you know, if it's rainy outside or there's no cloud cover, then we can't shoot that day.
Mm-hmm.
So we take these pictures, and then we go out and we take soil moisture samples, and we correlate the two pieces of information. And then Vigor basically gives you a very useful map that tells you how much water does every vine need in order to correct for its difference. So, you know, in a parcel, right, in a little block of a vineyard, when the winemaker goes and decides when to pick the fruit, I mean, you can argue that alone is the most defining moment of any wine ever, right? It's the highly subjective nature of what you consider a ripe berry.
Right.
So when Tina's out there, you know, eating her weight in grapes every day, trying to determine
this, figure out if it's time.
should we pick today? Should we pick tomorrow?
Yeah.
That is a really subjective thing. But what she doesn't like to see is when she's walking through the rows and she's tasting the fruit and she notices those slight variations in ripeness, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes a compromise. Here by the road, there may be a little more compaction in the soil. So the root systems access the water and nutrients differently than, say, the roots out in the middle of the parcel. And that can affect, over the course of a 240-day growing season, can really affect the grape's ability to ripen evenly with its neighbors. Mm-hmm. And of course, since we go and we pick all the fruit in that little parcel together, we don't say, well, let's go pick every ninth plant because it's impractical.
Right.
The way to correct that is to essentially adjust the irrigation or the cover crop or whatever other, you know, metric or, you know, lever you can pull on and say, let's grow. Instead of farming the group as a group, we farm the individual vine to grow as a group. And the way you do that through big data analytics and is with this tool, Vigor, it helps us adjust the irrigation on every plant every week so that by the time you get to your ripening period, you have hopefully corrected for all of that wow. slight, you know, variability in ripening. And it really has helped boost the quality.
It's amazing. Wow. Now, is this Vigor system, is this something that your family invented?
Well, you know, again, I mean, this is what I studied in university. You know, I these sorts of GIS applications have been around forever.
Okay.
I mean, there's really not that much novel to it. I think what is unique about what we've done is that we have gone out and said that there is a value proposition in saying we would like to shoot our vineyards twice a week.
Gotcha. Like the protocol or the application of it is kind of where you've put your unique spin on it. And I have to ask, because I love how all of your entire family is involved in the winery. Like, who is it? I'm just guessing. Is it you and your dad who are really like loving this aspect of it, or is it your sister or your wife? Like, you know, how does that break down into it? I know your mom and your sister are so into the culinary side of things and pairing food and wine.
Yeah.
So is this for you and your dad, or is it everybody, or?
No, definitely the, we all have different strengths, like any family. We work very well together. I mean, this is a family who has lunch and dinner, you know, at least 5 times a week together.
Wow.
Lunch feels like a boardroom and you know, it's a lot of, we're a big loud Latin family, a lot of volume, a lot of passion.
Sounds like fun.
We like to get work done and we like to problem solve together and that's really fun, you know. So my sister, if anybody in the family has sort of the closest or shortest string to the stylistic connection with the wines, I would say is definitely my mother and my sister.
Okay.
And so, you know, my sister and I work very closely together every day. And so a lot of the, let's say the challenges that they run into, what my team will do and is we'll go and we'll sit down with them and we'll start, you know, saying, you know, how can we solve that? You know, whether it's a new piece of equipment we're going to build or, you know, a new software protocol, whatever, you know, we'll sit down and we'll actively try to solve their problem or
right.
make their lives better, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's a lot of fun. I really enjoy working that way. It's a family affair.
Yeah, and you see, it sounds like, well, I mean, you have to have just this great synergy But you're right, like you all synergize, how do we fix this and make this better? And that's sounds like a lot of fun. And I'm sure the fabulous wine makes it even more fun.
Well, you know, and that's, you know, and I have to say, you know, a lot of projects we work on, a lot of them get scrapped because, you know, we think they're going to do something and then they end up not doing it. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're very proud of the ones like Felix and Vigor that did work and resulted in a good direction. But if you don't see the results in the wines, then they don't survive. You know, that's
right.
The goal has, I mean, they have to live up to actually improving the product.
Wonderful. And that makes sense. And that's so smart, right? It has to deliver or, right, it doesn't get used anymore. So, I mean, it's just fascinating. And I could go, gosh, I could ask you 10 more questions just about the technological aspect of the winery, which I love. But I want to kind of pivot and talk about the wines a little bit now. Because you make, and red wine specifically, because you make, it's three different Cabernets, Chardonnay, Riesling, and Muscat. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So we make, so for the Cabernet, so we have a wonderful wine club and we have some of the funnest customers, you know, all over the world. And, and it's called the Brassas Wine Society and it's a really fun wine club. And so we make,
I'll be sure to link that up in the show notes too. So for everyone listening,
the way that we sit down and make the wines is basically, Tina and Mia, along with usually my sister, and my mother, will sit down and taste all the ingredients. And so in a typical vintage, let's say just to simplify the math, there's roughly about 300 barrels to a vintage. And so those barrels represent, you know, the free run in the press of all the components that the vineyard produced that year. And so they sit down and they taste everything. And they sit down and they make the very, very best wine they can, which is the Cabernet Sauvignon, the Palmas Vineyards Cabernet Sauvignon, which is that is a wine we will make every single year for sure.
Right. And you'd say the Cabernet is kind of the focus of the winery, yeah. Correct?
And it's a blend and typically has above 95% Cabernet and can sometimes have 1% Cab Franc and sometimes can have all five Bordeaux's in it. Through the years, you know, almost 20 years of making these wines, we have seen basically, you know, think the Palmas Cab is designed to be the symphony. It's the best wine we can make with what the vineyard gave us that year. And then when they're done making that wine, there typically is one ingredient that was a shining star as a component to that wine, which sometimes they call the anchor point of the wine. And if there is enough of that ingredient left over by itself, they will bottle it by itself. And that becomes a wine that we call Gaston, which is 100% Cabernet, typically from a single parcel. And that wine has not been created every year. It is only true to its form. It's only created when there's enough of it. And the Palmas Cab doesn't take all of it. And so I think we've only made a Gaston in 2001, 2, 5, 7, 8, 10, 12, 13, 14, 15. So, you know, so it hasn't been made every year. It's a special wine, but it's 100% Cabernet always. And then
that's your namesake wine, correct?
Yes, yes. And my son takes, you know, that name as well.
Wonderful.
And then we sit down and we make a wine that we make for the club called Brassas. So Brassas is the name of the club. We make a Cabernet called Brassas. And that wine is we sort of take our Malbec component. We have about 3.5 acres of Malbec growing up the upper elevation. And we make kind of a Malbec-focused Cabernet, which ends up being around 15%. And we kind of joke about this wine. This is not a real wine term, but we kind of joke it's sort of the super Argentinian. You know, so if they're like a super Tuscan of Cabernet.
Absolutely. I love that. I think that's fantastic.
And it's a great wine. It's very bold and it's a great wine to pair with foods cooked by fire. And gotcha. And so we really, you know, Brassas is a really exciting wine to make. And we make that, you know, exclusively for the club. And then with everything else, it doesn't make it into the, and this is typically how it goes. You know, you have all these wonderful ingredients, but sometimes the premium wine just doesn't need any more of that ingredient, but it did get some of it. And so we get to sit down and make our second, our true declassified label, which is Sierra Knoll Vineyards, which is Henry Hagen's label, revived. And that is our second label, Sierra Knoll Vineyards, which is a tremendously excellent wine, considering that it's made from the same property.
Wow.
It's the same top tier, no expense, spared process of winemaking and French oak and everything. So, but we need Sierra Knoll to exist so that Palmas can be as focused as it is. And
That's
kind of harkens back to the Bordeaux era of having true D class wines. And so Sierra Knoll is that for us. And that wine is not sold at the winery. It's 100% wholesale.
100%. Gotcha. Wow. I mean, that's such a beautiful lineup of wines. What's your opinion of kind of the last few vintages in Napa? Do you have any favorites? Do you have any standouts personally that you're enjoying?
We've been Napa from a weather pattern perspective has been spoiling us since 2012, right?
Yes.
there's been some big headliners in there, of course. We can't talk about that era without talking about 2017 and the fires and then even 2018 and the smoke. So I think there's going to be some interesting choices to be made in the winemaking programs. I'm sure this is it's a hot button topic in every winery now, but right now.
Were you guys affected much by that or?
No, we definitely were very affected by the Atlas fire. It burned the entire property. The vineyards themselves, act like fire breaks, so they don't burn.
Right.
We lost a guest house. I mean, compared to neighbors, we made out like bandits. I mean, we did very well. I mean, I know people who lost homes and everybody does. I mean, the devastation was horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
We chose not to pick our fruit after the fire. This is, obviously there's a lot of opinions flying around about this, but we had 22 tons of fruit that we did not pick after the 2017 fire because we felt that the smoke taint was just too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're going to take a hit in the production, and we've done things like this before. In 2015, the wine that just released now is way, way lower in production than I'm sure the customers would like. And our club is, club members are graciously understanding that they may receive a bottle less, out of their allocation this year.
That's Mother Nature. And that's so true. Like even with the advent of all this amazing technology, at the end of the day, Mother Nature really still dictates what's going to happen every vintage, right?
Absolutely. And, and I guess what I'm proud about, I think what our team did a good job in deciding is that we, even in 2017, are going to be able to produce a wine with no apologies, right? There's no need to create a smoke taint label, right?
Yeah.
I'm not dogging wineries that are doing that. It's just from our perspective, I have to live with these wines on my table for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
The end consumers will purchase them, they'll drink them, they will cycle out, and the wines will go off into history. But they live in my cellar, on my table, as a reminder of my accomplishments and the result of our decisions for the rest of our life. And so the way I look at it is, I might as well make something that we're still proud of, 20 years from now, and not look back and say, "Ooh, maybe it wasn't worth to pick those 22 tons."
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Like, as somebody who's experienced smoke tainted wine before, and you're right, everyone's going to make their own decision based on their unique circumstances. But I think your customers will understand. I mean, out of your control, and rather than to deliver an inferior product, I mean, you're putting them first, and you're right. And I don't want this to represent us if it's not at the level to which we strive for.
You know, and I think there's an expectation, I think, from our customers and those who, you know, come to know what a bottle of Palmas should be like. I mean, they're paying an exorbitant amount for these wines. And I think that it shouldn't be, you know, 10, 15 years from now, if you're at your favorite restaurant and you're not shopping the right side of the list that night, and you're really just going for a special occasion wine. I don't want people to, you know, have to feel like, ooh, we should avoid, you know, 2017 or 2018, and then be surprised and have to find out later on that, oh, well, that was their smoke taint year.
Right. You know? Exactly. And, exactly.
So I think there's an expectation there that there's a consistency in the quality of the wines, and there's things we can control and there's things we can't. Mother Nature, you know, reinterprets itself every single year. And I love that. I love that the wines have personality, and I can taste that, you know, super sun-drenched fruit from 2008. And I can taste those cooler extended springs in 2009. Yeah. That's the personality of the wine. We're not trying to take that out of the part, but smoke taint, it's a separate category for me, you know.
Right. It is. And I applaud you. I applaud that decision. I think it's great. And for everyone listening, the Palmas wines, these are collectible wines. I mean, these are wines, right. They're expensive. You're going to lay them down in your cellar. They make a beautiful addition to any cellar. They're just fantastic wines. And again, right. It's consistency and the terroir. Like, you want your wines to reflect the beauty of where they come from, which I applaud you for that decision.
Thank you.
Yes. Let's see. Oh, and as far as food pairings for your amazing wines, I wanted to delve a little bit into that. I know your mom and your sister are just, I mean, do they still have a business where they do recipe development or what? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. So, so we're big foodies, you know, we love when you come to the winery and you visit us and, you know, you do an experience with us. It's always one-on-one. We never mix customers. So you're paired with our wonderful ambassadors and taken through the whole process. Is a 2-hour experience, and you sit down in a private tasting room and you do this awesome tasting with all these beautiful pairings. And
yeah,
food is important. You know, I think our no wine really loves to be all by itself. You know, all wines love to be with something delicious.
Amen.
And, and a big part of that, you know, one of the largest companies the family owns was started by my mother and my sister, called Goodheart. Yeah. And Goodheart is today is one of the largest kind of all natural or organic poultry producers for some of the largest grocery chain stores across the United States. So like Costco and Wegmans and, you know, all these big grocery store, Sam's Club. Mm-hmm. And they're really proud of the products they make, and, you know, it's basically kind of we're unique in that we can take sort of healthy, approachable, simple ingredient list items and make them affordable for everybody. And you know, my sister wrote an incredible cookbook, which you can see on our website, and
great.
It dives deep into the world of wine and food, and kind of centered around a lot of like what our Brasas members experience when they come to the winery, when they visit our events, and it kind of ties a little bit of our Argentine heritage and sort of the big asados, and, you know, always, wonderful. So her table is called At the Table and Around the Fire, you know. So
I love that.
It's very family oriented, And I also wrote a book. She was kind enough to let my book go in as a 2-volume set. My book is all about winemaking and sort of the technical side of my book's called Tradition, Terroir, and Technology. And so
how cool.
It's a 2-volume set. It's really fun, kind of a coffee table book. But I will say her book has already been reprinted twice and mine has been only reprinted once. So
that sounds amazing. I'll be sure to link that up on the website. We have Valentine's Day right around the corner too. What a great set. Cause you have and for people listening, a lot of people who listen, cause my biggest passion is pairing food and wine, which is wonderful, but there's a lot of folks and love to learn about technology and winemaking too. What a great thing. I'll be sure to include the link to that. That's fantastic. And how wonderful that like every member of your family seems to bring their own unique, you know, component or strength to the group. And you've created just this amazing, amazing thing and great experience for people who come to visit. And so are you open to visits and appointments?
Absolutely. Yes. We're open. Okay. By appointment only. Gotcha. And, but you know, we're open year round and, you know, we're all about receiving the customer and taking, them through the process the way they want to go through the process. And gotcha. it's great. You know, we really pride ourselves in, we receive people from all over the world and, wow. You know, we have translators and we're ready to receive, I think, in like 7 different languages. And
wow.
You know, it's a really unique way to see a winery in Napa Valley. And it's great because you get to do it at your own pace. You're not mixed with another group, you know, who may have a different level of wine knowledge than you.
Right.
You know, and you get to go through it and spend as much time you want diving into the subject you're interested in. You know, so if you want to see, you know, the most state-of-the-art optical sorting system in the world, you can come and just spend 2 hours talking about that if you want, you know.
What if you want to see it all?
Well, that's what most people
do. They
want to see it all. And it's a lot of fun. And you know, we try not to forget that, you know, this is meant to be fun and right. meant to be, you know, a memorable experience and something that, you know, people, I like to think, enjoy the wines the same way we do, where, you know, they get to go. Some of the best wines in the world for me are the ones I went to go and actually pluck right from the winery, you know, mm-hmm. and the memories and the trips to Europe and, you know, dragging the kids and the you know, all the craziness around those trips is so much fun.
Yeah.
And those bottles come back to our tables and come with them, the memories. And, you know, you pop the cork and you can almost smell that whole trip, you know, that amazing pizza you had in Nice or whatever, you know, all of that is just right there. And I'd like to think that, you know, those who come to Palma's Vineyards get to do that whole experience with us and have a really fun time doing it.
Well, I'm sure everyone listening is extremely excited. I'm excited to visit later this year too. And I've just, you know, friends of mine who visited are just bowled over and say it's amazing. So I'm sure you're going to be getting a lot of calls, hopefully. And right. for people who are interested in purchasing your wines, or where is the best place to find your wines? I know some of them are just allocated maybe to wine club. So is wine club maybe the best way to do it, or can people find you at retail stores as well?
Yeah, you know, our wines are available in a lot of different ways. I encourage, obviously, that process to begin by calling the winery. Mm-hmm. The winery has everything available, and we can ship to most parts of the world. And you know, but I also encourage your, you know, local shops. What's unique about local shops is that they sometimes get a backlog of back vintage stuff, you know, so the winery typically sells out pretty quickly of the current vintage in right about 12 to 14 months is typically. So we try and keep 2 vintages kind of active at the winery. And when you come and do tastings with us, we try to at least show you 2 years, if not 3 years of perspective, depending on what we have.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, so if you came to the winery, I think they're tasting 15, 14, and 13, right side by side. It's a really kind of a fun time of year. But right. That 13 is in, you know, very, very short supply. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those, some of the whites that, you know, that like the Riesling, for example, a dry Riesling that it is a very small production and unfortunately cannot be, you know, there's not enough of it to try and put it in the wholesale world. Mm-hmm. So that's only available direct from the winery.
Right.
Same thing with the Muscat, you know, like so those wines are.
Yeah. People who belong to your wine club, would they get access to those wines sooner than others, you think, or?
Yes. I mean, the wine club gets priority, obviously, and mm-hmm. they receive the shipments as they, you know, so the wine club members, you know, there's sort of three different levels, but, you know, they'll receive those three bottles of the latest vintage, you know, that time of year. And they're obviously welcome to order more if there is availability. You know, but the wines are out there. I continue to buy wines, even our own wines outside the winery because there's like, yeah. You know, there's just no more 2007 Gaston in the world.
Right. And cause you only make like a few hundred cases of each wine, right? I mean, these are not
correct.
Right. Just you know, very small production, special.
Some wines have larger productions, like the Palmas Cabernet will have a pretty sizable production and, you know, a couple thousand cases and you'll be able to find it. It's, you know, and, but like the Gaston and these other wines are really hard to find. And, you know, so when you do find them, and the price is right, you know, I gobble them up all the time.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. If he's snapping them up, all of you need to snap them up. And anyone in Florida who's interested in purchasing them, you can email me directly at Stephanie@theglamorousgourmet.com. Happy to help you out with sourcing any of them because they really, really are so, so special.
You're definitely. Right. And you know, we have, in particularly in Florida, we have such great distribution there. Mm-hmm. And great distribution partners have been with the winery for over 20 years. And they get all those fun toys. There's actually a special edition 3-year vintage wooden box that was made just for a couple southern markets like Texas and Florida.
Really?
I think. So yeah, I don't know. I think we made 300 boxes. I think they have three bottles of, I can't remember. I'd be guessing, but
I'm going to look into that and I'll definitely post it in the show notes. That, what a great idea that is.
Yeah. That was our marketing team who, you know, so the wholesale world does get fun stuff, you know, and typically, you know, if you're working with your local wine shop, you're probably getting a good deal too, you know, because they're not marking up stuff that crazy.
Right. Right. Wow. Well, Christian, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your family's story and telling us about your amazing wines. And I know people are excited and are going to be looking for them and visiting you. And I really appreciate you being with us today.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And for any of the resources mentioned in today's show, you can find that on my website at theglamorousgourmet.com/episode14. And if you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to subscribe. And thanks so much for tuning in.